Well, distinguished delegates, ladies and gentlemen, we're rather in an interesting position. It's something symbolic about scientists, and we are a panel of scientists here, sitting in the position of the politicians to discuss the interface between science, society, policymakers, and politicians. Perhaps if we stayed here long enough, would develop even greater sympathy for the difficulties of our policy and political friends. But as has already been said, and indeed has been a theme of this meeting, for much of this meeting, there's a really important issue at stake here. We all know that science and the technologies that derive from science and using science in the broadest definition of the word are critical to solving the multiple problems at every level from local to global that we face. But we also must accept that science has had a place in creating those problems. The population explosion and everything that grows from that, the development of technologies is of course the things that have led to climate change issues and so forth, so that society rightly, at the same time as it needs science, also needs to have controls on what science and technologies do. And so we have an interesting set of healthy tensions that have to exist between the science community, society, the policy makers, and the politicians who ultimately, on behalf of everybody, have to work through these difficult trade-offs. And I think everybody in this room, as the President said in his address to us, acknowledges we're a critical point in history where it is clear that the role of science and the proper use of science is going to be essential for those massive environmental, social, and human challenges that are upon us. And so, over the last decade, we've seen an increasing interest in this interface between science and policy. It's manifest in a number of ways. We've seen, for example, a number of countries move to create explicit systems or structures to interface between the science community and the policy community. Science advisors, the science advisory mechanism in Europe, for example. And now I chair a network called the International Network for Government Scientific Advice, which brings policymakers, practitioners at this boundary, and academics together to discuss the principles and increasingly to train young people so that they can work at this interface. And what is becoming clear, and I think what will become clearer by the end of this panel, is that we need to start thinking about the business of science advising as somewhat different to the business of science and somewhat different from the business of policy. There's a need now for something that's distinct in the middle. And the demand from young people to be engaged in that process is immense. Next year, with the help of Minister Pandor from South Africa, my network will be running a workshop in Africa for young people who want to learn about science advising. We have 40 places in the to offer. We have 395 applicants for those 40 places from every country in Africa. The demand is there, and sometimes we need to meet it. So let me just make a few more remarks by turning to our panel, each of whom has a somewhat interesting perspective on these issues. First of all, it's not always clear what science and advice and science advisory systems mean. And I think some of the contention that has surrounded discussion in this area has come because people have not understood what these words mean. We need to distinguish between science to inform policy development in general from policy for science. We're not here primarily talking about how you develop one's indigenous science system, your funding systems, your research community. We're talking about how science can assist policymakers to do what they have to do and make some very hard decisions in very complicated circumstances. Of course, there's some flow over between the two, but they are distinct. And if you recognise that difference, then the issue which I think some of the panellists will discuss here today comes to what kind of skills, aptitudes, and mechanisms are needed at that boundary between science and policy. The other point to make, which I think I do not really need to make in this audience, but I can't help but do so by way of introduction, is to point out that increasingly we talk about evidence-informed policy rather than evidence-based policy, for the simple reason that there's much more to policy formation than science alone, and that what we need to do is recognise as scientists that policymakers have many other considerations that come into play in making their policy: fiscal considerations, policy priorities, public opinion, electoral contract, diplomatic considerations. They're all part of the policy process, and scientists have no more ability to comment on that than does anybody else. The final introductory point I would like to make is to recognise that science advice is not unitary. There's no one way to do it. There are multiple dimensions to it, and there are indeed multiple needs within a government or across governments. For example, most often when we talk about science advice, most people think about deliberative advice. That is where a question is put and a group of experts, often a national academy, will do research upon it and over some months or even some years return with a report to the government, to the minister, or to the policy community. But think about that. It depends on whether the demand side and the supply side, that is the policy side and the science side, actually agree on what is the question that's being asked. Is the question being asked the one that really needs to be asked? Secondly, it can only enter the policy point cycle at one point. And thirdly, it's often a very slow process. On the other hand, all governments need scientific input all the time. They need it in an informal sense. They need it at every point, even before the questions are framed. And how does governments get that informal scientific advice very much depends on the nature of public reason and the nature of the political and policy process in different countries. But it's important to remember that policy development is not as described in textbooks. It's a messy process, conflated with politics and it's iterative. And here one needs to recognise that if science advice is to play a role in that, there needs to be trusted relationships between the science advisory mechanism and the policy process to be sustained. And that trust becomes critical at one time in the third type of science advice: emergencies. When there is a crisis or emergency, the science advisory mechanism moves from just being a theoretical construct to being in the real world of helping politicians making real decisions in real time. And is increasing recognition, and this was a discussion that was at the Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation Council of Science Advisors meeting 2 weeks ago, which Zachary co-chaired with me, that is increasingly apparent that where governments do not have a robust mechanism for integrating broadly based scientific inputs into emergency management, the risks of bad outcomes are enhanced. So I think a number of principles around science advice are now emerging, and I hope over these two panel discussions we might see how that emerges. So I'm going to ask each of the four panelists to make some introductory comments in turn. Then I'll try and foster some engagement between them. Then I will open it to the audience. There'll be a roving microphone. Shows you I'm still a scientist, you see, at heart. Actually, you need a telescope here to see people. And then we will see where the conversation goes. So without further ado, Paddy Cunningham, who I must acknowledge when I was first a young science advisor, some of his advice to me was very sound. I'd like to ask Paddy Cunningham, who is formerly the chief science advisor to the Prime Minister of Ireland, Republic of Ireland, to make some comments.